that was Earth.
Después de esa pieza, vamos a escuchar una comunicación simpática y cruel con Ani.
That's Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Every other Wednesday from 10 to midnight, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland, no compromise in defense of the truth.
Rev up your support for KBOO Community Radio. Have an old car taking up space? Donate it to KBOO. Your unused vehicle can become music to our ears, powering independent radio that amplifies diverse voices and community perspectives. It's easy and hassle-free. Either visit kboo.fm/cars or call 1-877-KBOO-123. You'll get a tax deduction and the satisfaction of supporting local independent media. Donate your car to KBOO Community Radio today and drive change in your community.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio. Of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. I'm a public school teacher, and Rachel and I host every second Monday of the month, but Rachel is not with me here today. We typically interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions, but unfortunately, today we had a last-minute cancellation from some of our friends, our union siblings in Albany, at Greater Albany. So you're stuck with me for a while. I have not done this before where it's just been me talking, so we'll see how that goes. I might put you to sleep after a few minutes. I hope not. I just quickly jotted down a few notes. I don't know if it's going to last the length of a typical show, which is about 25 to 30 minutes, but we'll see. It's an experiment. Thanks for joining me, though. And, you know, I think I want to really just start with what's going on. How are people feeling? How are we going to respond to the election of Donald Trump? A lot of what I've been seeing so far coming out of our union has been around how do we talk with our students and, to a lesser extent, you know, our members' feelings, and sort of trying to address those and reassure people that, hey, we as a union will continue to fight for you. We still have your backs. And I think all of that is important. I think we have to probably, that's probably a good starting point, right? Because if we don't acknowledge people's feelings and we want to go immediately into plans of action without first acknowledging where people are at in their feelings, I think it's harder for people to make that jump. So I think that that's okay. I think that's that response is okay. But I also think that, you know, for me and probably some of you out there that are listening, yeah, we can talk about feelings for a bit, but And let's get back down to fighting the good fight, right? One of the things that I'm noticing too is when people are talking about why did the election go this way? Why did Trump win again? And there's this tendency to want to blame the voters, right? Well, it's these, they're what's the term? Not mis or underinformed, but low information voters, as they have sometimes been referred to. And I think that's a big mistake. I think that we should not be blaming the voters for what happened. To me, that is like blaming our students for not learning, right? Like, we don't blame our students, or I should say, we shouldn't blame our students for when they fail, when they don't pass their class, or when they don't learn the material that we want them to learn. We can blame our students, but then where does that get us? Does that lead to any growth, any improvement? Does that address anything? No. So we need to look in the mirror when we're teachers, when we're educators, and our students aren't learning. And we need to look in the mirror when we get these voting results that a lot of us, certainly me, aren't happy about. We have elected somebody now whose priorities are really to cut the taxes for the wealthy, for corporations, to open up our lands and our waters to new drilling. He wants to scapegoat and blame immigrants, right? He wants to go after our transgendered folks. He wants to he's talked about doing a lot of things, and yeah, we can sort of wonder, well, what's he going to do? How much of that was just talk? How much of that is he going to try to do? What sort of protections do we have in place in our sort of checks and balances in the government that can slow him down or make it harder? We can wonder about some of that stuff, certainly. But I just want to get back to that point. I don't think that we get anywhere by blaming the voters. Do we have lots of voters who have sexist tendencies or beliefs? Yes, absolutely. And probably some of them didn't vote for Kamala Harris for that reason. Are there folks who are sort of, blatantly racist and just won't vote for somebody of color? Yeah, there probably are some people like that, right? But again, I think it's a mistake to blame the voters. I think we have to look in the mirror, and I think we have to look at the Democratic establishment. I think Bernie Sanders wrote something a day or two ago, a couple days ago maybe, that I read. I don't have it here in front of me. His basic premise was, hey, the Democratic Party has abandoned the working class, and so the working class largely has now abandoned the Democratic Party. And I think that that's pretty accurate. Now, there have been some good policies that have come out of the Biden administration. But a lot of the best things were really watered down, or he refused to really follow through on and carry out once there was some pushback. So I think that, a lot of the blame should go on the Democratic Party. And yeah, I think that that's where we need to be looking. And we need to be looking at our own unions too, right? Especially on the national level. What are our unions doing on the national level? Well, What I see is a lot of aligning ourselves with the Democratic Party. And as long as we are basically just cheerleaders of the Democratic Party, and as long as we continue down that road of, well, they're better than the Republicans, so that's what we got to do, then this is what we're going to get. Right? So it's kind of, you know, it's the definition of insanity. We keep doing the things that we're doing, we're going to keep getting the same results. So when I hear union leaders now say, hey, we're going to keep fighting, I think if we keep fighting the same way, we're going to keep getting the same results. So yeah, we're going to keep fighting, but we got to do some things differently, right? We can't continue to fight by lobbying Congress and trying to, you know, use our PAC money to get the next best politician, or the one that we decide we want to call a pro public education candidate. And so we put all of our eggs, in a sense, in that basket, and this is what it gets us. So I'm really a big proponent of moving more towards and putting more of our energy towards movement politics, as I think it's sometimes called, and less towards electoral politics. Not that electoral politics should be completely abandoned, no. Not that, you know, which party wins doesn't matter. Yes, it does matter. I think that's an oversimplification when folks say, well, both parties are basically the same. Yeah, there are a lot of similarities, and they are both, you know, beholden to big money. But there are also significant differences. I just think it doesn't get us anywhere when we make a statement like that. All right. Well, you know, I've been talking for a while, and I got to say, this is an interesting experiment here for me to just talk and carry on. And I'll have you know, too, that those of you that are listening, that I'm recording this on a Zoom. So I'm looking at myself while I'm talking. I guess I was hoping that maybe that would help me to feel like I'm not just talking to nobody. I'm talking to somebody else. You know, one of the things that I want to say, too, is that this campaign could have really gone after the price gougers, right? I think that's a big reason why at least at the top of the ticket, why Kamala Harris didn't win is she didn't really go, you know, full throated into talking about why prices went up so much, right? And that's a big part of why people voted for Trump, is they felt like he was going to address that, and prices went up largely under Biden. And so, you know, Kamala could have gone to some of these, you know, big companies that were doing a lot of price gouging, and she could have held rallies outside of those corporations or those corporate offices and pointed her finger at those offices and said, hey, you know, they raised the prices only for one reason, not because it costs them more money to provide the goods and services that they provide, but because they saw it as their opportunity to increase their profits, which then went into stock buybacks and then went into pad their, you know, whatever, their 401ks and their salaries of their CEOs. So, you know, why did she do that? Well, obviously, because like I said, the Democratic Party, just like the Republicans, they're both beholden to big money, and the Democratic Party donors wouldn't want her doing that, right? I was going to have Greater Albany Education Association. There were a couple of folks that I was hoping to get on. They are building towards a strike. And so I totally understand as that potential strike date is approaching, just November 12th. So this airs November 11th. So the day after. Yeah, so you're listening to this. And the day after, they could potentially be walking out, which is very exciting, right? We haven't had a lot of teacher strikes, educator strikes here in Oregon. It's starting to feel like we have gotten close several times. And of course, we had the big one last year with Portland Association of Teachers, which was very exciting and had a huge impact across the state in terms of the wins that other locals had. And now it looks like Greater Albany Education Association is about to go on strike. I was super excited to have an opportunity to interview a couple of folks there. So we will try to get them on next month, and that will most likely mean that if they've gone on strike, their strike will probably be over by then, and we can talk about that. But I want to give a shout out to Greater Albany. You got this. Fight hard. Don't believe the hype about strikes being scary. Well, yeah, they can be a little scary, but we got you, right? And I'm planning to be down there for your rally to show my support. So fight the good fight. Win yourselves a good contract. Win yourselves a contract that also looks at your working conditions, which, of course, as we say, are our students' learning conditions. I wanted to spend a few minutes now reading Eric Blanc's, some of his points about post-election, his thoughts post-election. All right. So Eric is an educator. He's a teacher, and he has he's also a writer, and he wrote an amazing book called Red State Revolt, in which he basically embedded himself and hung out and interviewed all kinds of educators from West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, states that were walking out on a large level and illegally. And so, amazing book. He's a great guy. And here's what he wrote. I'm going to read to you for a little bit here. Here's what he wrote. He says, after spending 48 hours in shell shock mode, here are some initial reflections on what went wrong and how we can defeat Trumpism. Number one, blame the Democratic Party establishment. Tuesday's loss is what happens when you leave workers behind for decades, from Clinton's NAFTA to Obama's austerity to Schumer's pivot to suburban professionals, to going scorched earth against Bernie's movement in 2016 and 2020. Number two, establishment Dems are royally screwed up this cycle. It was suicidal to embrace Biden's candidacy despite his dementia and unpopularity. Pundits praised Pelosi and company for eventually pushing Biden out, but it's inexcusable that they didn't do so a year earlier and allow for a real primary. Number three, the only chance the Dems had at winning in 2024 was by running someone outside of the Biden administration, probably someone like Gretchen Whitmer. And though Bernie was too old this time around, it's worth remembering that he won over exactly the people Harris struggled with: workers across the country, Latinos, and Joe Rogan bros. It's true that in number four, it's true that inflation has seriously hurt incumbent administrations worldwide, but their electoral defeat isn't an iron law. Despite widespread inflation, Mexico reelected its left government because it delivered big and communicated well to working people. Number five, incapable of seriously looking at the Democratic Party's flaws, many elitist liberals are already blaming ordinary people, claiming most Americans are irreparably brainwashed or prejudiced. This is something that I talked about in my introductory remarks. But if this were true, it's hard to explain why Americans elected Barack Hussein Obama in 2008. Number six, Democratic hacks are also claiming Dems need to move back to the center. because Biden's relatively progressive domestic policies and appointments failed to deliver the goods electorally. But after decades of Democratic abandonment of working people, these steps were too little, too late. Number 7, had Manchin and Sinema not blocked an ambitious Build Back Better agenda capable of delivering visible improvements in most people's lives? And had Biden been able to consistently string together coherent sentences? It's not inconceivable that our country's recent political trajectory might have been different. Number 8, given that most unions only represent 10% of the workforce and made so few attempts to recruit new members over these past 4 years, it's not surprising that Biden's pro-union policies did little to reverse the Democrats' fortunes among working people. Number 9, the sad truth is that top union officials, with a few notable exceptions, failed to seize an exceptionally favorable opening for mass unionization created by a tight labor market, a very good national labor NLRB, and a grassroots revitalization driven by young, radicalized workers. Risk-averse union leaders mostly continued with business as usual, sitting on billions of dollars that could have been used to launch and support wide-scale, worker-to-worker unionization initiatives. And number 10, and maybe I'll pause at that point. Number 10, had most unions massively invested in new organizing after 2020, this could have significantly changed the political map. Not only do union members continue to vote more Democratic, but high-profile union drives and strikes polarize the whole country around class instead of culture wars and expose the Republicans' sham populism. Experiencing solidarity and collective power firsthand is the best antidote to scapegoating. There's no path to defeating the far right that doesn't pass through expanding and transforming the labor movement. All right, so I think he makes some fantastic points. He goes on to talk about how workplace organizing is going to be harder, but not impossible. He talks about funding the genocide in Palestine and how that contributed to losing Michigan. He mentions that Trump's election is a big blow for democracy. He talks about by far the biggest mistake made by the left this cycle was not to run a viable candidate in the presidential primary. We forgot the main lesson of Bernie 2016 and 2020. Without a leftist tribune in our country's most important political contestation, we were either confined to being marginal outside critics or being uncritical junior partners to Biden-Harris. This abstention left more space for the Democratic establishment to downplay economic populism and for it to ignore widespread anti-war sentiment. We can't make this mistake again in 2028. He finishes by saying that we'll all get through this collectively, not as isolated individuals. And I think that's a great ending point for this. Before I let you all go, I want to say that what matters most is not who is sitting in the White House, but who is sitting in and who is marching outside the White House pushing for change. That quote comes from Howard Zinn. So thank you for joining us on KBOO. You've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 o'clock to catch another Labor Radio show. Thank you.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
This is KBOO Portland. You're listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. Before we get started, I want to remind you that KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform. That means we're funded by you, the listener. If you enjoy Prison Pipeline, then please show your support by making a contribution today, or better yet, by becoming a monthly sustaining member. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks!
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can